marched ahead of the canoes, searching for Indians. The early August sun beat down on the hikers. On the first day of the month, Lewis described himself as much exhausted by the heat of the day, the roughness of the road, and the want of water. He nevertheless discovered and described the blue grouse and the pinyon jay. He found a profusion of berries, now ripe and in full perfection. We feasted sumptuously on our wild fruit. He saw more beaver signs than he had ever thought possible. He named two tributaries of the Jefferson River. We called the bold, rapid, and clear stream Wisdom, and the more mild and placid one Philanthropy, in commemoration of two of those cardinal virtues which have so eminently marked that deservedly celebrated character, Jefferson, through life. The junction of the Wisdom and the Jefferson presented a familiar problem. Which river to follow? Lewis decided on the Jefferson, not because it was bigger, it carried less water than the Wisdom, but because it was much warmer, from which I concluded that it had its source at a greater distance in the mountains. He wrote a note to Clark, recommending that he bring the canoes up the Jefferson if he got to the junction before Lewis returned from a 2-day scout for Indians. He stuck the note on a pole at the fork of the river and set out with Driard, Charbonneau, and Sergeant Gass, who had disabled himself in an accident and was in great pain, too much so to work a canoe, though, according to Lewis, he could march with convenience. 2 days later, August 6th, Lewis returned to the area, empty-handed with regard to the Shoshones. Now he heard the whooping of the party to my left. He marched toward the sound and found Clark and the canoes on the Wisdom River. They were a sorry mess. One canoe had just overset and all its baggage was wet, including the medicine box. Two other canoes had filled with water. Immediate action was necessary. The first object, Lewis wrote, was to examine, dry, and arrange the stores. They made a camp on a gravel bar at the mouth of the Wisdom and spread the stuff out to dry. That job done, the captains talked. Why was Clark going up the Wisdom? Hadn't he seen Lewis's note? He had not. The captains puzzled over this, then concluded that Lewis had put the note on a green pole. A passing beaver had cut it down and carried it off, together with the note. The possibility of such an occurrence never once occurred to me when I placed it on the green pole, Lewis confessed. Clark had not agreed with Lewis on which river to take. He had gone up the Wisdom because he thought it went more directly in the direction the expedition wanted to go. But the Wisdom was much too narrow, willow-infested, rapid, and twisty. Clark said that he had met with Driard before Lewis came up, that Driard had informed him of the true state of the two rivers, and that he was in the process of turning around, which was what caused the canoe to upset, when Lewis arrived. Another worry. Clark had sent Private Shannon ahead, up the Wisdom, to hunt. When Clark met Driard and decided to turn around, he told Driard to proceed upstream, catch up with Shannon, and bring him back. But toward dusk, Driard came in to report he could not find Shannon. Lewis ordered the trumpet sounded and had the men fire a couple of volleys, but Shannon made no appearance. In the morning, August 7th, the captains decided they had so far exhausted their supplies that they could proceed with one canoe less, so they hid and secured one in a thicket of brush. In the afternoon, they made 7 miles up the Jefferson. Shannon failed to join the party. On the 8th, they made 14 river miles, but as Lewis noted, although we travel briskly and a considerable distance, yet it takes us only a few miles on our general course or route, because the river was very crooked, many short bends. 3 days previously, Lewis had noted that the men were so much fatigued today that they wished much that navigation was at an end that they might go by land. Morale and the energy level were sinking fast. The Corps of Discovery was becoming a walking hospital. Captain Clark's intestinal problems had disappeared, but he had developed a tumor on his ankle, which was much swollen and inflamed and gave him considerable pain. Sergeant Gass, Charbonneau, and 4 or 5 of the enlisted men had various indispositions. Everyone was more or less exhausted most of the time. But that afternoon, Sacagawea again gave the men a much-needed lift. As Lewis put it, The Indian woman recognized the point of a high plain to our right, which she informed us was not very distant from the summer retreat of her nation on a river beyond the mountains which runs to the west. She said the Shoshones called the hill the Beaver's Head, from a supposed resemblance of its shape to the head of a swimming beaver. She assures us that we shall either find her people on this river or on the river immediately west of its source. So close. The man wanted to hide the canoes, put the baggage on their backs, and march to the dividing ridge. But if the captains let them do that, they would have to leave the greater part of the baggage as well as the canoes. And in Lewis's view, we have a stock already sufficiently small for the length of the voyage before us. They had to have horses. As it is now all important with us to meet with those people, the Shoshones, as soon as possible, Lewis wrote, the captains decided to send out an overland party that would stay out until it located the Indians. Clark wanted to lead it, but the raging fury of a tumor on my ankle muscle made it impossible for him to walk. Lewis's determination was absolute. His intention was to proceed tomorrow with a small party to the source of the principal stream of this river and pass the mountains to the Columbia, and down that river until I found the Indians. In short, it is my resolution to find them, or some others who have horses, if it should cause me a trip of 1 month. In the morning, before breakfast, Lewis did some writings, which I conceived from the nature of my instructions necessary, lest any accident should befall me on the long and rather hazardous route I was now about to take. What those writings consisted of, no one knows. It sounds as if they were written instructions to Clark in the event he did not return. Did he tell Clark to press on, whatever happened to him, or to fall back to St. Louis and try again the next year with a bigger party? This was the first time he had done such a thing. Clearly, he felt he had arrived at the critical moment and that he was in a do-or-die situation. He was a man whose mind never stopped working, and during his long walks on the plains or in the mountains, he had plenty of time to think, even though his eyes were constantly picking up flora and fauna, geographical features, the distance to this or that spot, and registering them in his mind so he could write about them in his journal. That was the naturalist explorer in him, and his interest never flagged. But he was also an army officer operating under orders to go to the Pacific and return and report, and he was a company commander responsible for the lives of 30 men. So what was the military officer explorer thinking? In that capacity, Lewis was a worrier who took care to put his concerns down on paper. The question, "Where is Shannon?" led to conjecture. Lewis's thought was that he must have shot an elk or two and was waiting beside the Wisdom for the expedition to come to him. Which river to take? Can we possibly make it without horses? Always he worried about the state of the men's health and wondered how much more of this they could take. As to what he thought lay ahead, on August 10th he wrote, "I do not believe that the world can furnish an example of a river running to the extent which the Missouri and Jefferson's rivers do through such a mountainous country and at the same time so navigable as they are." His men were already questioning that word navigable, but his optimism remained. If the Columbia furnishes us such another example, a communication across the continent by water will be practicable and safe. This had to be the triumph of faith in Jefferson at the expense of what he was seeing with his own eyes, the men at their uttermost limits and still so far to go. His realism returned to him. This, a short portage and an easy float to the Pacific, I can scarcely hope from a knowledge of its having in its comparatively short course to the ocean the same number of feet to descend which the Missouri and Mississippi have from this point to the Gulf of Mexico. His mind covered the continent. If the Columbia had only one-fifth the course to run to get to sea level as the Missouri-Mississippi, and if they started out within a short hike of each other, then the Columbia was going to have lots more falls and rapids than anything they had so far encountered. But his fixed rule was always to assume the road ahead was good, until proved otherwise. Only a tiny number of people have ever had the experience of not knowing what they would see when they got to the top of the mountain, or turned into the river, or sailed around the tip of a continent. Lewis expected that when he got up the mountain to the divide, he would see something resembling the country he was traveling through. Long, sweeping valleys dropping down to the broader valley of the Jefferson, Only in this case, the stream would be running to the south branch of the Columbia. Whatever he saw, he was either going to find horses on this trip and get over the mountains and onto the Columbia, or die in the attempt. Aside from his own calculation about the nature of the Columbia, he seldom wrote about what he expected to see. He did write about what the Hidatsas told him. Their information was awfully sketchy beyond Three Forks and non-existent on the western side of the Divide. Lewis's theoretical expectation, learned from Jefferson, was that the Rockies were a single chain of mountains like the Appalachians. But given that the Rockies were so much higher than anything east of the Mississippi, he really didn't know what he would see. With regard to the Indians he was seeking, he neglected to think through his situation. He just blundered ahead on the unshakable and unacknowledged assumption that he was such an expert in handling Indians that when he met a Shoshone, he would know instinctively what to do. If he ever interviewed Sacajawea about her people, he didn't consider it important enough to put into his journal. If he ever asked her what the country beyond the Divide was like, he didn't write about it. Clark's asking her how to say white man in Shoshone was the full extent of the captain's interrogation of the most valuable intelligence source they had available to them. That Lewis did not bring her along on the most important mission of his life is inexplicable. She had made long marches before and could again. Also inexplicable was the failure of the captains to talk with each other and to bring Driard and Charbonneau in on the discussion about what to do when contact was made with a Shoshone. Furthermore, Lewis held no conference with Driard and Privates John Shields and Hugh McNeil, the men he had selected to go on the mission with him, to tell them what to do when an Indian was spotted, how to behave, what signs to use, what to say. Lewis had good reason to believe the Shoshones would welcome the expedition. The tribe desperately needed contact with white traders so that the braves could arm themselves and fight the Blackfeet, Hidatsas, and other enemies on more equal terms. Of course, Lewis wasn't bringing the hard-pressed Shoshones any guns, only the promise that if the Shoshones cooperated, American traders would come to their country. Short term, Lewis needed the Shoshones far more than they needed him. Long term, their fate was tied up with the success of the expedition. But how to get them to recognize this would be a problem. So would getting past the initial moment of contact without anybody's firing or running away. These problems required a plan and a strategy, but the captains never developed either one. At breakfast on the morning of July 9th, a good omen for Lewis's mission. Shannon came in with three deer skins and an adventure story that had a happy ending. "Immediately after breakfast," Lewis wrote that night, "I slung my pack and set out." The first day he covered 16 miles. The second day it was 30 miles, ending up in "one of the handsomest coves I ever saw of about 16 or 18 miles in diameter." He had followed an old Indian road, but it gave out on him. On the morning of the 11th, he met with his party and gave out the closest thing to a plan he could come up with. They would spread out across the valley, headed west, looking for the Indian road. Driard would go out to the right, Shields to the left. McNeil would stay with Lewis. If Driard or Shields should find the road, he would notify Lewis by placing a hat on the muzzle of his rifle and holding it aloft. They marched abreast for 5 miles. No sign of a road. Suddenly, Lewis squinted, looked again, took out his telescope, and saw for sure an Indian on horseback about 2 miles distant coming down the plain toward us. His dress was Shoshone. His arms were a bow and quiver of arrows and was mounted on an elegant horse without a saddle. "I was overjoyed at the sight of this stranger," Lewis wrote, "and had no doubt of obtaining a friendly introduction to his nation, provided I could get near enough to him to convince him of our being white men." Lewis hiked on at his usual pace. The Indian horsemen came on. But when they were about a mile apart, the Indian stopped. So did Lewis. Lewis pulled his blanket from his pack, threw it into the air, and spread it on the ground, which he understood to be a signal of friendship. Unfortunately, this signal had not the desired effect. He still kept his position. He was glancing from side to side. It seemed to Lewis that he was viewing Driard and Shields with an air of suspicion. Of course he was. The Indian was probably a teenager out on a scout, curious about these strangers, but cautious, brought up to fear all strangers. Coming at him were four armed men. How could he not be suspicious? Especially since the Shoshones had just suffered a serious loss of people and horses from a Blackfoot raid. Lewis wanted to make Driar and Shields halt, but they were out of shouting range, and I feared to make any signal to them lest it should increase the suspicion in the mind of the Indian of our having some unfriendly design upon him. Lewis spread out the pitiful supply of trade goods he had brought with him, some beads, a looking glass, a few trinkets. Leaving his rifle and pouch with McNeil, he advanced toward the Indian. The Indian sat on his horse and watched until Lewis was within 200 yards. At that point, he turned his horse and began to move off slowly. Desperate, Lewis called in as loud a voice as he could command, "Tababone!" repeatedly. Instead of responding to Lewis, the Indian kept watching Driar and Shields as they advanced. Lewis was furious with them. Neither of them having sagacity enough to recollect the impropriety of advancing when they saw me thus in parley with the Indian. Finally, he broke his rule not to make signals. He signaled them to stop. Driar saw and obeyed. Shields, who afterwards told me that he did not observe the signal, kept coming on. At 150 yards, Lewis repeated, "Tababone!" and held up the trinkets in my hands and stripped up my shirt sleeve to give him an opportunity of seeing the color of my skin. At 100 yards, the Indian suddenly turned his horse about, gave him the whip, leaped the creek, and disappeared in the willow brush in an instant, and with him vanished all hopes of obtaining horses for the present. I now felt quite as much mortification and disappointment as I had pleasure and expectation at the first sight of this Indian. He was sorely chagrined by the conduct of the men, particularly Shields, whom he blamed for the failure. "I now called the men to me," Lewis wrote, "and could not forbear upbraiding them a little for their want of attention and imprudence on this occasion." Blaming them wasn't going to accomplish anything, however, and Lewis's refusal to assess his own mistakes in the encounter is noticeable. Surely he was just as guilty as they were, if not more so. But he directed his anger at them. He had left his telescope with the blanket he had spread. McNeil had neglected to bring it along with the blanket, and Lewis seemed to take a bit of pleasure in ordering Driar and Shields to go back to search for it. When they found it and returned, the party set off on the track of the horse, McNeil carrying a small U.S. flag attached to a pole. Thinking that the Indians might well be watching from the surrounding hills, and not wanting to give them the idea that an advance on them was being made, Lewis halted at an open place, built a fire, and cooked and ate breakfast. But just as he started out again, a heavy shower of rain raised the grass and wiped out the track. He saw several places where it appeared to him that the Indians had been digging roots that day, which meant the main village couldn't be far off. At 20 miles, he made camp. On the morning of August 12th, we fell in with a large and plain Indian road. It passed a stout stream. Here we halted and breakfasted on the last of our venison, having yet a small piece of pork in reserve. They hiked on, headed toward a pass, the stream growing small as they ascended the gentle slope. At a distance of 4 miles further, the road took us to the most distant fountain of the waters of the mighty Missouri, in search of which we have spent so many toilsome days and restless nights. He assessed the impact on himself. Thus far, I had accomplished one of those great objects on which my mind has been unalterably fixed for many years. Judge then of the pleasure I felt in allaying my thirst with this pure and ice-cold water. Lewis was not alone in his rejoicing. 2 miles below, McNeil had exultingly stood with a foot on each side of this little rivulet and thanked his God that he had lived to bestride the mighty and heretofore deemed endless Missouri. Now was the moment to go to the top of the pass, to become the first American to look on Idaho and the great Northwestern Empire. Lewis described the moment. "We proceeded on to the top of the dividing ridge from which I discovered immense ranges of high mountains still to the west of us, with their tops partially covered with snow." To what degree Lewis was surprised or disheartened by the sight, he never said. John Logan Allen asks us to imagine the shock and the surprise. For from the top of that ridge were to be seen neither the great river that had been promised, nor the open plains extending to the shores of the South Sea. What Allen calls the geography of hope had to give way to the geography of reality. With Lewis's last step to the top of the divide went decades of theory about the nature of the Rocky Mountains, shattered by a single glance from a single man. Equally shattered were Lewis's hopes for an easy portage to a major branch of the Columbia. But whatever Lewis felt as he first saw the Bitterroot Range of the Rocky Mountains, he never wrote about. Nor did he write about his feelings as he took his first step on the western side of the divide, outside of Louisiana. He descended the mountain, which was much steeper than the approach on the eastern side, about 3/4 of a mile, to a handsome, bold running creek of cold, clear water. Here I first tasted the water of the great Columbia River. The party proceeded another 10 miles or so before making camp. As we had killed nothing during the day, we now boiled and ate the remainder of our pork, having yet a little flour and parched meal. Lewis was deep into Indian country with only 3 men and his main body 3 or 4 days' march away. He had a few gewgaws as his currency. He had a frightened Indian reporting back to the Shoshones that strangers were in the area. He had just been through enough experiences for an entire expedition, all in one day. He needed a good night's sleep and lots of good luck in the morning. Chapter 22. Over the Continental Divide. August 13th to August 31st, 1805. On Tuesday morning, August 13th, 1805, Lewis set out early, headed west on a plain, heavily and recently used